handle the truth.
Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Prick Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. Welcome. We're back. Kenny Powers is back. Yeah, we're back. We took 3 weeks off, and by we, I mean me. You know, just self-care. Self-care, folks. Oh, man, do I have contempt for so many modern terms and self-care. Is definitely one of those terms. Speaking of self-care, here's a joke I wrote down. You guys get a preview for it, of it. I said, I want to either do a sketch or just use it as a bit on stage, and I'm trying to figure out which way it works best. By the way, it's February 22nd in the year of our Lord 2021, approximately 12:45 p.m. on the East Coast. I have had my tea and nuts, but I had tea and some walnuts, and then a box of Goobers, which are chocolate-covered peanuts, because I thought, for Black History Month, we'll do a little remix of my usual nut snack. We'll make it less healthy, more delicious. I call them Wakanda peanuts, okay? I think that if Goobers really wants to get their shit together, they should rebrand and call themselves Black Panther peanuts, okay? Because Goobers, not getting it done. As Adam Carolla said in his first book, which... Still, this will sound like really weird praise or really absurd praise, but there's very few books that have made me laugh out loud. That includes comedian books, fiction, but Adam Carolla in 50 years will all be Chicks and The Bonfire of the Vanities. Probably the two books that I've laughed out loud the most while reading. Bonfire of the Vanities, of course, J.L. Covan's number one fiction book of all time. But yes, so I had Goobers, so I should have a little bit... even more energy than usual, which is not a hard bar to surpass. But I'll probably just crash miserably while walking Cookie this afternoon, like when that sugar high comes down from my Black Panther peanuts. But the bit that I thought of, I said, whenever I read these articles of like, how is the corporate world, the offices of tomorrow going to have to adjust to the new reality of COVID and coronavirus? Ooh, that was quickly turning into Ron Reagan, not afraid of going into the office, getting coronavirus, dying, and burning in hell. Little Ron Reagan remix. See that, guys? A few weeks off, did the body good. I'm coming out guns blazing with all the podcast obscure classics. But people are like, oh, they're going to have to adjust. You know, there's going to be workplace changes. And I thought a funny sketch would be, how far do you make the workplace accommodating to what we've been through. And I was like, you know, if an office was, if you're like a real estate agent trying to sell office space or rent office space, it's like, and in this room, your workers are free to come in and masturbate and play video games after an hour and a half of work. You know, just we've got numerous OnlyFans and porn sites right there, verified, of course, none of that Pornhub stuff. And, also, video games. So if you get bored after an hour and a half of work, you can just take a 15-minute coffee break, which ends up being 2 hours of Spider-Man and a quick trip into the dark nether regions of the internet, and then you can go right back to your office. So it's like we've made all the accommodations. We're treating it exactly like homework, but safe. I don't know. Stupid idea, I know. But I think that would be funny if you just incorporated into like a real estate tour everything that people do at home. You know, taking it to a really dark place, it'd be like, remember how pesky, you know, we want the safety of home, but remember how pesky it was with your kids running around doing that remote learning? Well, right in this room, we have abortions on demand, so. Oh, that's dark. Anyway, yes, yeah, I've been thinking a lot about mortality. Why don't we get into it? I've got a bunch of stuff to talk about, folks. It's been a few weeks. It's just been me, the righteous girlfriend, and Cookie. So you can imagine as I plunge deeper and deeper into Jack Nicholson, The Shining territory. I'm trying to be happier with you guys. So why not talk about mortality, right? Last year I made a lot of money, and I'm meeting with my accountant. Well, virtually, okay, guys. Let's keep it safe. Meeting with my accountant soon to go over all sorts of stuff and different retirement accounts I can now open. And I laugh at that because I'm like, the peace of mind to be able to retire and know that when I'm 65, I'll be happy as fuck. And I'm like, first of all, will I even make it to 65? I'm a large man with a lot of anger and hate in his heart, as well as goobers in his heart. Now rebranded, of course, as Black Panther Peanuts. But it's so weird to be like, yeah, you know, now I know that my later years will be happy. But I think as a big dog, I think, if I'm being honest, I think it's up to me to maximize my happiness before the age of 60. I'm not Bill Russell. That's about it. That's Bill Russell is like 87, 88 years old, but he was a pro athlete and a righteous man, a civil rights warrior, a professional athlete. So you're really dealing with cream of the crop genetics there in terms of just his spiritual and physical health. As stressful as being a black man in America was for the 20th century, he lived a righteous life and presumably a healthy life. He's like, you know, 6'9". That's it. I don't know any other giants walking around. Like Wilt Chamberlain, his counterpart, you know, died probably mid-hump with his 25,000th sexual conquest in like his early 60s. So I feel like part of me is like, do I have to maximize my life enjoyment before 60? Because let's be honest, unless I get healthy real quick, I don't see myself having an enjoyable elderly life. Like, God, the worst thing here would be like, oh shit, I'm 78. At my current trajectory, I'm like, this sucks. I mean, I'm glad I'm alive, but other than that, I'm creaky. I'm even crankier. I'm in the 45th year of my podcast that nobody. So I feel like I've been thinking about mortality a lot. Like I'll get a toothache and I'll be like, damn, when are my teeth going to stop hurting? I'm like, wait, they're not. It's presumably shit will just keep getting worse. And I was like, but when does it stop? And I'm like, oh, right, with death, that's when it stops. And then that gets me thinking to the afterlife and to my family members who've passed on. And I don't know. It's just, I'm not even like depressed about it, but it's just you think about these kind of things, I guess. And I feel like COVID, all you have as a deep philosophical and negative person, COVID in a way is a rough time because you're just constantly pondering things. You have all this time to philosophize. Thank God my day job just gave me a new assignment and it's sort of like, it's a good one. So I'm like able to get into my day job for a little bit and be like, oh, thank you for giving me a break from my own thoughts. But I was thinking, you know, because my uncle, I just, my uncle's, I'm one of the beneficiaries of my uncle who passed away in September, a very close member of the family, an immediate member of the family. Like, my immediate family to me was five people. My uncle lived across the hall from us. He moved into the building my mom still lives in in 1985. We moved in 1986, and he was my next door neighbor for, you know, most of my life. And my mom's next door neighbor for you know, 34 years. But it's when you get like the it's one of those weird things when you're just like, it doesn't sum up a person. And, you know, I'm getting a nice amount of money, I guess. But it's like one of those things where you just go, you almost feel bad. You're like getting this. It's like, here, this is, I can't put it into words, but it always makes me feel guilty. I mean, I've obviously inherited very little because I've been blessed to have a family that lived a long life. Most of my parents' money was tied up in joint things like their apartment and my mom, and then my mom's pension. So my dad didn't have like a lot to in his name other than the apartment when he passed a few years ago. But it always feels weird to just be like, okay, here's your check. And it made me think, like, I was thinking of other things. Like, I don't know if there's a point to this, but I was watching Roots with the Righteous Girlfriend, which is just, it's on HBO Max right now. And I gotta say, gotta be on the Mount Rushmore of television. Got to be. Like, for me, after rewatching it, because I watched it in school, the first few parts in high school. And I was, you know, that was obviously over 20 years ago, but I remember thinking, wow, this is like for the 70s. This is really good. And even watching it back again, obviously some of the makeup and stuff, but man, what a series. I'm not kidding you. Like, it's the 70s for some reason, I guess people maybe coming out of the 60s were just bolder in their art, but Roots is just one of those things where you're like, yeah, I think somebody said they redid it, and I'll never watch that. I feel like that's like redoing The Godfather or some shit. But like, yeah, if they remade Roots today on Netflix or something, it'd be like gorier. Like, there'd probably be more. It'd be like Amistad and 12 Years a Slave. But for what Roots did as like this pioneer of television, I mean, it was graphic. It was, you had all these white famous actors just running around, like Rod of the Black Guy Who Tips, who, by the way, is the guest this week on Making Podcasts Great Again. So double reason to listen to that. He always gives credit to like white actors, and maybe Chris does too. I think it's Rod though, Chris Lamberth, my other podcasting bud, I think it's Rod who says like he gives credit to white actors who are just willing to go full on racist and like jeopardize their careers by just going full authentic villain. Like, the best example for me up until Roots is like up until rewatching Roots was DiCaprio, who in Django was incredible. Should have been nominated. They should have nominated Christoph Waltz for best actor and DiCaprio for best supporting actor, but I think they just wanted to get the award, so they put Christoph Waltz, who's in the movie for like 2 hours and 10 minutes and has the most dialogue, as a supporting actor. It's absurd what they let them do with the Oscars, how they let them game it. But DiCaprio was the quintessential supporting actor. Came in for like 50 minutes of the movie, just throwing 100 miles an hour of like passionate, evil racism. But not in like a goofy way. In like a real, like this, like, but in Roots, you had like the Brady Bunch dad just being racist, Ed Asner being all over the place. Like, it was just, it was like jarring even to watch now. And it was like for this to come out of the gates in the 70s. But the 70s also gave us All in the Family, which is one of the great shows of all time. And I'm just wondering, the Mount Rushmore of television, just all television, would be what, barring like obviously this is the first broadcast of a television in 1931 or whatever. Like, I'd say Roots. Maybe like Neil Armstrong landing on the moon for like event, right? Like I'd say Roots, Neil Armstrong, Ken Burns, the Civil War, and first season of Kenny Powers, Eastbound and Down. How about that? I mean, I wish I was kidding with that. But no, I just think, you know, obviously TV shows, there'd be heavy competition for that slot, but I feel like Neil Armstrong landing on the moon, roots like have to be on the Mount Rushmore of television. But I'm watching Roots and I see an actor and I go, who is that guy? I always play that game, you know, and I'm starting to feel like I'm getting older. Maybe I'm not exercising as much. My brain is starting to atrophy a lot quicker under COVID circumstances. But I'm watching this guy. I go, who is that guy? I've seen him in a movie. Why can't I remember who that guy is? And I look him up and he was Rocky's promoter. He was Apollo Creed's promoter in Rocky One. And I thought to myself, I was like, that's a good decade for an actor. You know, like you're in Roots, you're in Rocky. That's a best picture and an Emmy winner. Like that's a good career, let alone a good decade, let alone a 2 year period or 3 year period. And then I looked him up and I was like, he died, I think it was like at 51 in like the late 70s. And ever since my dad, I think I've said this, but ever when my dad passed away, I was very sad, and I did a lot of, in therapy, a lot of digging into re-examining, you know, as a kid, you see a relationship of your parents, and then as you get older and you examine things, you see it a lot differently. And my dad was, I think, a man of great patience for the most part, and but he died in a nursing home at 85, and it was, as sad as it was, and as many questions as I had, you know, once he passed that I couldn't ask, it felt a little more organic, you know, like he had a full life. And now sadly his sister passed away early in COVID, not from COVID, but early. And she was the last of, I believe, 10 kids in that generation. But it felt in a way natural. And my uncle's passing was the first thing. It really felt like even though he was 70, it just felt jarring and quick. And it wasn't from COVID, but it was as swift and jarring as COVID, partly because my uncle kept certain health things, I think, from everybody, probably trying to maintain some positivity in his own mind and didn't want to be confronted with things. And in hindsight, maybe he should have just, instead of getting chemo, gone, you know, the kind of hospice sort of route of like, let's just make these last few months comfortable. But that's a decision for every person. And I can't act like if it was my own life that I wouldn't be the fuck it. I need to live. Like, I want to live. Like, let's do what we have to do so I can live. So that, you know, but he, I think, whatever. But I've been thinking just a lot more about death and mortality ever since my uncle passed, just because it was much more jarring. It was a much more visceral sort of loss, just because even though he was 70, it like came out of nowhere. And as any of you Bible scholars know, as they say, as Jesus said in one of the parables, I can't quote you the verse, but they just stick in my mind. You know, something about God will visit you like a thief in the night. And I think that's just meaning be ready. Whatever you consider that, obviously Christianity will have its own definition, but it's that it's a little bit of a carpe diem, but instead in Catholicism, it's more like, it's not so much carpe diem, like go out and party. It's more like get your soul, make sure your soul is ready. Like always be in a state of preparation for, because you never know when your time is up. A more secular person, you know, there's a way to be both also. It's like live a good life, live a life that makes you happy, and hopefully they coincide. Hopefully a good life, a righteous life, and also a good a happy life are coinciding for people. But that was like my uncle passing away was really, it shook me up in a different way than my father passing. And like I said, it wasn't like losing a child or losing a parent young or anything, any of those tragedies, but it still was just different for me because I've had this very lucky, fortunate life of having the people that matter to me and that love me around for a long time. But the reason I bring this up is I'm watching Roots and I just had this moment, and this keeps happening to me where I keep thinking about life in bigger, and this isn't to make me sound profound or anything. This is just what's going on in my head. This is what happens when I don't have a podcast to yell at for 3 weeks. But I was just like, that guy has been dead for longer than I've been alive, or for like the same amount of time that I've been alive, that actor. I'm not even remembering his name, but I'm remembering the face from those two, from Roots and from Rocky. And as I'm sitting there, I'm going, wow, it's kind of like he's alive again. in a way. Like, he did this work that obviously was meaningful work. And I was going to write this on Twitter, and then I jokingly thought, somebody's going to find the actor and be like, you know, he killed himself because he was found diddling his nephew or something like that. So I didn't post it because I was just like, I don't know. But I'm just, when I see this guy doing this work, this meaningful work, being in these important artistic things, and it's triggering something in my memory to go, why have I seen that guy? And then you go, oh, that's great. He was in Rocky and he was in Roots. Two good things. Good for you, sir. What are you up to? You've been dead for 41 years? Well, all right then. But it made me think of Coco. A movie that, it's hard to call it the greatest Pixar movie of all time, but the way that movie hit me, I think it's probably, as much as I love Finding Nemo and Toy Story, I don't know if I can have a Pixar movie above Coco, because I just thought what that movie did visually and spiritually was so beautiful. And the whole point in the movie, spoiler, this is kind of a theme of the movie. If you haven't seen Coco and you listen to this podcast, for Christ's sakes, go watch Coco immediately. It's on Disney+. But the whole thing was like, it's you know, the idea, and this works for, you know, secular and religious people. Cookie, get out of there. Hey, Cookie has this thing where she just picks around the bathroom garbage. She's you know, you can take the dog out of the streets, but you can't take the street out of the dog. But I was just thinking, Coco was like to live on, for someone's spirit to live on, it requires people to remember them among the living. And it's such a profound thought, and it's one of those movies. There are movies that make me tear up from sadness. The big three for me are E.T., Dead Poets Society, and Glory. But there are other movies that I almost tear up, like, and District 9. I remember District 9 is just such a, holy shit, what a movie that is. But Coco is like one of the few movies that I like tear up with a smile on my face when it's over, because it's so rousing and like uplifting, but it's almost not upsetting, but almost it's just sort of like overwhelming. I think the movie is just a beautiful, beautiful fucking movie. And it just made, you know, and then I thought of this actor and I was like, wow, it's like his work lives on. And it's like he's living on it. Maybe he is. Maybe it's metaphorical. Maybe it's literal. But yeah, that's the kind of shit that goes through my head. And it's as sad as those thoughts can be, they're a lot better than just being angry at people for being stupid comedy fans. You know, that's my point. It's a different kind of mood, I guess, when I don't have this podcast. I do less griping and more philosophizing. And then you just think of the age of the earth and you go, we are all just a blip. It's so weird. It's so weird to think that like the earth is like billions of years old, like dinosaurs were here millions of years ago, and that's just a blip in the age of the earth. And then we're just like a blink of the eye, like human existence is just a blink of the eye. And these aren't things that necessarily get me depressed, even though some might say, doesn't that conflict with some of your spiritual or religious beliefs? And it's like, yeah, I know. But, I don't know. COVID's weird, right, guys? It's like I just sit around and try to tie in the existence of Earth with my uncle's death and an actor who's in Rocky in the movie Coco. And that's it. That's your pod. No, that's not your podcast for the week. Let's talk about more fun stuff, shall we? Watch the Patrice O'Neill documentary on Comedy Central. Speaking of other enjoyable things that are now dead. Patrice, for those of you that follow me, he's on my Mount Rushmore of comedians. And he's also one of the three best shows I've ever attended that I've ever worked on. I had opened for, of the people I've opened for in my life, Patrice O'Neill, Sebastian Maniscalco, and Gary Owen are the three hardest sort of kills, all at the DC Improv. Although I worked with Gary Owen in Cleveland as well. But man, and Patrice, like Maniscalco, I remember I watched every single show. Just when my set was over, I went out and just watched every single show, and it was just masterful in their own ways. But the documentary, my mom saved it. I don't have Comedy Central. That's a long discussion about why I had to switch from a perfect cable package for me to get some basic bitch channels like TLC and Bravo. Totally reconfigured the cable package. This you have to remember I signed up for before I was a one-hit wonder rich person in 2020. So I was like, all right, I don't want to spend like $200 on cable. How can I keep this under $200? And my package was $132. But then to switch that, because the guy lied to me and told me that the basic bitch channels were included, to get those, I had to jump to a different package, which then eliminated things like Comedy Central and NBA TV, and it was $30 more. Now, if I wanted Comedy Central and NBA TV, those channels back, I would have to go up to another level, which would have been like an introductory price of Fios of like $205 a month. And I was like, fuck that. Now it ain't no thing, but on principle, I'm not doing it. So I've been without Comedy Central since I moved to New Jersey. But it's also my philosophy, which is I don't want a comedy channel that doesn't put me on their comedy channel, which is why I have no comedy channels. But my mom saved it. She watched it and she saved it. And I thought it was interesting. She left the room for like 45 minutes because that was when Patrice started talking about fingering chicks and eating ass and peeing in his girlfriend's mouth. Just little clips from his stand-up. And I thought it was what a beautiful reversal because I remember when my mom let me start watching R-rated movies like The Godfather when I was 11 years old, her thing was like, if it's a good movie, you can watch it. But I had to leave The Godfather at one point after seeing all the violence because, as I learned later, that's when Michael's young Italian bride took off her shirt. And so I had to leave. That's the old Catholic way of watching movies. It's like, yes, come back in the room now. It's only Sonny getting shot 400 times at a toll booth. But as long as you didn't see those breasts, we're all good. Well, my mom, in this case, she left the room. So it was a real circle of life moment. Like she was censoring herself instead of me. She was like, I don't need to sit here with my son while Patrice talks about fingering women. And I thought, thank you, mother. Thank you. Whose birthday is tomorrow, by the way, or when you're listening to this? It's February 23rd. So happy birthday, mom, who doesn't listen to the podcast. But the Patrice O'Neill documentary is awesome, I thought. More in depth than I expected. A lot more personal stuff. It was cool to learn about him. He was a great comedian. And I did resent the fact that they referred to who was it? Which comic? A British black British comic called him 6'7" in the video. I was like, he's not six. He was not 6'7". There's only one 6'7" bridge burning, overweight, misanthrope comic genius in this world. And you're listening to him. Patrice was like 6'4", maybe 6'5", maybe 6'5". Maybe a little of the weight had slouched him a little bit as he got older. But he was awesome. He's you know, with Chris Rock, Gary Goldman, and Greg Giraldo with Bill Burr, first one, last one out. That's my Mount Rushmore of comedy. But that was good. I recommend it. I recommend both to listeners who are big comedy fans and also maybe more stand-up novices. Even if Patrice's material is not necessarily your cup of tea or all of it is not your cup of tea, I think it can be very instructive to people who want to understand my comedy philosophy a little bit better. It will help you, for sure. But it was, I really enjoyed it. And one of the things that stuck with me, aside from sort of the personal stories, one of which was pretty, sort of intense and unexpected, was when he talked about getting the show Web Junk on VH1, which was sort of a precursor to Tosh.0, which obviously became a humongous, humongous hit for and moneymaker for Daniel Tosh. But Patrice said in an interview, he was like, I don't really want to be the Web Junk guy because, okay, so Web Junk becomes who I am. And then you get these 18-year-old girls coming to a show, hearing him do his real stand-up going, this isn't funny. And I thought, my God, that is on a much smaller level. That has been my nightmare ever since the Trump impression blew up. The only difference is the Trump impression to me, I'm pretty vulgar and edgy within the confines of the Trump impression. So it's always weird when people are like, I'm making jokes about Trump double teaming like underage girls with Jeff Epstein. They're like, oh, that's so funny. And then once I make a joke that's like 1/10 as offensive, but it doesn't involve Trump, you get a bunch of, that's punching down. That's not okay. That's blah, 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 blah. So yeah, it was, I recommend it highly. I recommend that documentary very highly for my fans and for comedy fans in general, and for some people who are not, maybe, who honestly wonder why I'm always so bitter and angry. So, you know, that's that. I also watched a different documentary on Amazon Prime. My former, you know, I'm always going to have mixed feelings about Adam Carolla because, one, I think the man is genuinely funny. I always hate whenever he does something that people hate or don't like, and they go to the, this guy has never been funny. I'm like, but that's just not true. He's really quick-witted and really funny. And like, if you're listening to a podcast, he's right up there in terms of people popularizing the format. So like, that aside, it's like, have your critiques. For Christ's sakes, I don't go on his show anymore. Like, so clearly I have ideological differences with him and even more importantly, his fan base. But like, going to the, you're not even funny, it's so dumb because it's disingenuous. But he had a documentary called No Safe Spaces that came out. I never saw it here, but it was on Amazon Prime. And I said, you know what? I already watched Roots. Let me get a little alt-right chaser just to even out my racial balance again. No, I wanted to, I just said, let me, if I don't like it, if it's as cheesy, if it's like some Dinesh D'Souza production, I'll turn it off in 15 minutes. But it was actually, I thought, not terrible. It's obviously slanted. It's obviously biased. It's Carolla and Dennis Prager, one of these sort of, he's a very avuncular kind of conservative, but he plays it as a very, I just want to have discussions and I just want to, and part of that seems true, but you know, a lot of his shit I don't buy. But the main gist of the doc, and there are little tells, like they're interviewing, Prager is interviewing some guy towards the end of the movie who comes a very polished, I forget his name, a Jewish name, nice looking guy. I think Dennis Prager describes him as like a lifelong Democrat who's Jewish, but obviously has found some sort of alliance with this sort of movement. And I forget what his name is, so forgive me, but if you ever watch it, you'll know who I'm talking about. But he comes off as very sort of reasonable and blah, 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 the whole movie. And you're like, okay, man. And then at the end, he just, as they're summing up stuff, he has a quote where he's like, you know, and if you keep labeling people racist, homophobic, misogynistic, or any of these other nonsense buzzwords, this isn't Carolla or Prager saying, it's this interviewee. And I just thought, see, there it is. If I was making this documentary and really wanted my message, that's a quote to strike, because those things aren't nonsense terms. Now, if you're meaning that some people apply them too much, understood. But to call racism, homophobia, sexism nonsense terms, you tip your hand a little too strongly. That said, there were examples in the movie that I actually agreed with, that I remember reading about, like with Yale University and things. But the reason I bring that movie up, it's, many of you probably wouldn't watch it and you'd find it stupid or you're done with Carolla, and I get that. Like, I don't go on his show, not because I disagree with his approach to things a little too much, and it's more his fan base that I don't want to engage with, because it really has, as people like me, sort of his center-left fans who are like, well, it's good to hear people you disagree with, and you know, but I also think he's hysterical. It became too much. It became like a critical mass of non-humor political statements. Like when Trump became president was sort of when it started to wear on me, because he was a critic of Obama, and I thought to myself, okay, if that's his political side, he's going to be inclined to critique. But when Trump became president, he stopped being this kind of, I criticize those in power, and his big enemy became Elizabeth Warren. And I was like, you know, Elizabeth Warren isn't president, right? But it became this thing he had to find the next progressive thing to bitch about instead. That said, the show gave me a platform. I always had friendly exchanges with Carolla, of course, and But I think politically, I think he started to attract, he started to push away people like me, not intentionally necessarily, but and attract more and more when you're having Ben Shapiro's and Milo Yiannopoulos's on. And I don't know if he's had Candace Owens, but it wouldn't shock me. Like, it's just going to start to, you know, and then when the balance goes from 90 comedy, 10 politics to 50-50, it's like then it becomes not as enjoyable to listen to. But the gist of the documentary that I thought was valuable is that, and this is one of those things, I'm not like a strident, I am a First Amendment person, obviously, as a comedian. I don't maybe get up in arms about it because I think, especially under Trump, we had more consequential things that were also constitutionally protected, you know, things that were becoming crises under Trump. Like when there's an arsonist in the house, you don't worry about the kid lighting matches down the block. You worry about the guy who's lighting a fire in your house. It's not to say that they're both, that speech is not important and campus speech is not important, but I always got really bothered by people who sort of acted like there wasn't a clear and present danger with Trump. Like they ignored that for whatever reason and wanted to jump right to speeches at Berkeley as like the, and they can both be problems, but like, once again, there's a kid playing with matches down the block. We'll get those matches out of his hands right after you put out the fire that's in my house right now that I am standing in, would be my analogy from Trump's damage to speech curtailing. That said, I actually kind of liked most of the documentary. I could tell where there were things made in a very selective fashion, but the gist of it was that we have to keep embracing free speech. And I know this is kind of tricky for a lot of people, but, you know, the example I always give is Dinesh D'Souza, who I think at the time was just sort of a, you know, controversial conservative thinker, but not yet the kind of radical offensive joke that he is now. And I could be wrong, but he spoke, like my high school had him speak at an assembly. Not because they were endorsing it, but because it was like, well, we have this conservative speaker who's like doing a tour of schools. And you know what? I'm sure we got the speech he wanted to give to appeal to high school sophomores or high school seniors. And to be honest, if he gave that speech to the world often, he'd probably be taken more seriously. But instead, the money and the grift is in being super like polarizing, offensive, and crude, or if not using crude language, crude in your thoughts or in your exaggerations. But I never would think, oh, Dinesh D'Souza shouldn't speak at this high school. Just like today, if I had a kid in high school and they were like, Ben Shapiro's coming to talk, if I'm being honest, I would just say, well, if I want my kid to opt out, I should have that right. If my kid doesn't want to go, I don't, you know, high school's kind of tough. Like, you know, high school assemblies were pretty much mandatory in high school. But I don't think, I'd just be like, yeah, and then we can talk about what Ben Shapiro said and I can rebut things or hear you out, or maybe you'll think they're wrong to begin with because of the way we've raised you or your values. But the idea of like, it's one of those few areas where I go, yeah, I do think it's ridiculous that these college campuses would be like, we are banning X, Y, and Z. Like the trigger warnings, the microaggression stuff, and the banning of speakers. You know, one of the examples in the movie that I thought was weird was like, this one guy at a school wanted to have Patriot Prayer come speak at the school. And I thought, wait, isn't Patriot, like, and I didn't look this up, I could be wrong, but I was like, wait, but isn't Patriot Prayer like a militia? That, I think, isn't that one of those like militia groups? Like, to me, that's different than having like a thinker or a writer come speak and share their views. I'm like, I don't know if I'm down with Patriot Prayer. If I'm not mistaken, like, we got the Oath Keepers coming to an assembly. Why are you canceling them? That would be totally appropriate in my mind because their words have been coupled with action that is also dangerous/offensive. But it was the one thing in the documentary where I thought, I think this is a point that most people should agree with. And it is weird to be like at colleges going, yes, and I like, you should be able to cancel this speaker. It's like, don't go. Like, I honestly kind of don't get how it became that. The idea of, I don't like this person. Like, even Milo Yiannopoulos. Yeah, I wouldn't go to hear him speak. Or I might go as a critic, as somebody who's just like, I want to be there for this, the spectacle, which is where some of the money comes from some of these more aggressive, polarizing figures. But it is weird. Like, the one thing, the main gist of the documentary, where you have to be careful to see like other stupid things that they slip in. But the main thesis of colleges should be places of free exchange of ideas, and they should be safe places, but not intellectually kind of pure safe places. And it's just weird, because it's one of those things. I'm not a Dinesh D'Souza fan. I call him the Orson Welles of 0% movies on Rotten Tomatoes. And so a lot of stuff he says is so like historically bank. It's like, not only it's a lot of his stuff is like, he's like one of these guys who's obsessed with the fact that like Democrats started the KKK in the 1870s. And you're always like, that's the best you get. Like, that's still your big hook. but at the time it was just like, I could tell he was conservative. I was like, well, he's making some valid, like, all I thought when hearing him was, I mean, he's making some intellectually defensible, valid arguments. You don't have to agree with him, but like, yeah, that's an exchange of ideas. But the money is not in the fair exchange of ideas. It's in condemning cancel culture, skewing history, condemning the other side. And on a speech level and on a college campus level, I think it is, and I'm obviously now, as much as I want to think I'm still in my 20s, I'm a fucking 41-year-old. Like, I am a whole ass different generation than college kids. And it is a weird change in the environment when people, like, I don't even mind when kids protest speakers. That's also allowed. But it's the protesting that leads to the canceling of speakers that I think is like, is weird that that's become acceptable. So I do, like, that's one of, but this then becomes, this fair agreement on free speech becomes, you know, the because this, the left in some cases has given this opening, this justifiable opening of critique on speech to the right. Well, the right just obviously takes the words cancel culture and now applies it to any time, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse is, you know, he murdered two people and now they're trying to cancel him. Like, it's gotten to such a, the idea of canceling is now, you know, Timothy McVeigh, after he bombed the Oklahoma City, FBI building, he was canceled with the death penalty, the ultimate cancel culture. But I don't know. It was a very obviously different thing than, I mean, but the Patrice and the Corolla doc, kind of obviously are both two sides of a free speech coin. Obviously, watch No Safe Spaces if you're going to watch it with sort of a wary eye for a lot of the self-serving bullshit in it. But, you know, there's elements to it that are very valid and that I agree with. So that's part of the reason why I listened to Corolla longer than I maybe was totally comfortable with, because I do believe in that. As strident as I can sometimes be, I do want to hear other ideas, but if I disagree with them, I often will disagree with them vehemently, but I'm not necessarily looking to have someone shut up. Eventually, I guess. But, you know, Corolla was somebody that I was like, well, it's probably good to hear the occasional other side, or like where someone else is coming from. But then when you're getting harassed by his men's rights fans, you go, okay, well, this I don't need to be part of. And the other thing I watched, which was not a documentary, but it was sort of a dramatic retelling, was Judas and the Black Messiah on HBO Max. And that was a good palate cleanser from The Little Things, which is a terrible movie on HBO Max, starring Golden Globe nominee and Oscar winner Jared Leto. Good God. That dude stole Barkhad Abdi's Oscar. But I liked Judas and the Black Messiah. But movies, I'll tell you what, I would say it was a very good movie, for sure. But it's always weird when I see a movie and I'm like, that was a good movie. And then the epilogue like hits harder
than the movie. I mean, it's about Fred Hampton, the movie, and I do recommend it. Very, very much worth your while, worth your time. Trump will review it on this week's episode of Rotten Oranges for making podcasts great again, Patreon customers. But when the, I don't want to give away the epilogue, but like after seeing a jarring movie, the epilogue was like a much more disturbing punch in the gut. And that happened with me, a movie called Loving, which was about like the couple that led to the Supreme Court striking down bans on interracial marriage. So the movie Loving, which was not nearly as good as Judas and the Black Messiah, the movie Loving I watched, and I'm watching it. I'm like kind of bored by the whole movie, and I'm going to spoil Loving, so just be prepared. But I'm watching the whole movie, and I'm like, this is all right, I guess. And all of a sudden, the end comes, and the man in Loving, the white husband, after their case, you know, they go through all these hardships in their case, and they love each other. It's a deep, you know, imagine how deep and strong your love has to be to you know, to deal with all that shit where they're telling you it's illegal. And then he died in a car accident. This is the epilogue. Like, the movie is like 1 hour and 50 minutes of mostly boredom. And then the epilogue is like, he died in a car accident. And she never married again for the remaining 40 years of her life. And I felt like my eyes welling up. And I was like, oh my God, that is the saddest, most heartbreaking shit I've ever heard. And in my head, I'm like, why was this movie so boring? What a sad legacy. What a tribute to their love that she ended up never remarrying, and you know, who knows if she was alone, but being committed to that marriage that they fought for, and it was rewarded with a tragic, untimely death and solitude for several decades. And I was just like, God. And the difference in Judas and the Black Messiah was that the movie itself was compelling and strong, but I still felt like a gut punch from the epilogue versus Loving, which was just like, I'm about to fall asleep. What happened now? Like, it was, I would say, if anybody ever asks you, what was JL's movie, the greatest epilogue to movie ratio in cinematic history, it is Loving, where I'm like practically falling asleep, and yet the epilogue was so heartbreaking that it still kind of jolted me, even after being bored by the movie. Another one I rewatched a few months ago, Bugsy. I had only saw it when it came out on video when I was like 13, but I rewatched it, and Bugsy was had another depressing fucking epilogue. Spoiler, this is an epilogue spoiler episode. It, Bugsy Siegel, obviously, he gets murdered. He's the Mo Green of real life. And his chick kills herself. Like, the epilogue is like, you're like, oh, this is. And I was like, but God damn, these epilogue, like, show. I always get annoyed when the epilogue is like even more jarring than the movie itself. But there, that was the epilogue section of the fucking thing. In the book corner, I finished, I'm almost done. I have one more book, Andrew Weissman's Inside the Mueller Report. So I'm still not done with Trump books yet. So I have one more, which is the Andrew Weissman book, just to hear about how bad he fucked up, how bad, what's his name, Mueller fucked up. I want to read that. Andrew Weissman spilling the Justice Department tea. But I finished Woodward's Rage this weekend. My goodness, when you read this book, if you have, and if you haven't, that's okay. But when you read this book, holy shit, Trump is a fucking idiot. Like, I'm not kidding. There are quotes where you're just like, he's just rambling. Like, these are direct quotes, like paragraph long quotes where you're like, Trump doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know how to form a thought. He doesn't have a governing philosophy. He doesn't have an agenda. And you're sitting there going, if Woodward, when I read his previous book, Fear, which was his first Trump administration book, I didn't really like it that much. I feel like Woodward is a reporter who gets to write books, but like writing is a different skill than reporting. And I found his writing very dry. But in this one, I think it played well because there's so many interviews with Trump that you get to see Trump and read Trump in his own rambling stupidity. And I was just like, we're so fucked in this country that like there's still a political party that absolutely wants Donald Trump to be president. Like I can't, like, because they'll never read the Woodward book. That's the problem. Like Woodward is a respected, famous journalist who has reported on presidents of both parties. But the Trump people will never read. It's just like QAnon. They want to believe whatever the fuck they want to believe. But my God, reading Rage, I was just like, I was getting annoyed reading Trump's quotes because I'm like, just spit it out or just shut the fuck. Like you're reading a book going, well, this guy shut the fuck up already. Cause he would not give he would give answers, half answers, rambling, like, but it's just incredible. It's just incredible. Like for as old as Joe Biden is, when he gives a speech or something or is talking to the media, there's just, he may be slower in speed, but there's so much more depth of understanding, more obviously more empathy, but just much more understanding and competency comes across. Because that's my thing with Trump, is that he was not competent. Like, even if you like the bluster and you like the policies, he wasn't even good at the job. And that's what's so infuriating because you're like, but this guy, yes, we should. If you fell for like a Josh Hawley, who would obviously be a much more skilled tactician and smarter person than Trump, yes, there is great danger there, but at least I could understand somebody falling for a competent, intelligent grifter. Trump's a fucking idiot. And it was like infuriating reading. I was like reading Paris going, will you shut the fuck up? Like it just while reading, because I'm like, well, you're making no sense. You were blathering and you're the president. But there, I enjoyed that. I actually enjoyed that book more than Fear. So almost done with my Trump reading. One more Andrew Weissman. And then I can finally get to what will amount to my probably entire spring reading, which is Nixonland by Rick Perlstein, the fourth book in his like rise of the modern Republican Party, starting with Barry Goldwater. Great books. And I hope Nixonland is just as great. And it's also about 1,000 pages hardcover. The other one is Jonathan Alter's biography of Jimmy Carter. So this spring, and then I'm going to start mixing in some fiction, but I've wanted to read those books. I bought them last year, late last year, August and like September, but haven't gotten to them yet. So once I read Andrew Weissman, and also my righteous girlfriend's sister bought me Seinfeld's book, but that's an easy read because that's just like comedy for Christmas. So that's going to be my little in between, my intermission between Woodward and Weissman. We'll read Jerry Seinfeld's book. But yeah, there's a bunch of, I guess I gave you a bunch of recommendations. I talked about death, so that's always good. Yeah, look at that. And I didn't even really complain about comedy, did I? Not too much. If I did, I don't know. I enter a fugue state when I'm on this podcast, but I don't think I got into comedy gripes. So see that? Do you see, guys? I have comedy gripes, but I felt like there was so much more for us to talk about. Why gripe about comedy when you can talk about, existential fears and questions with life? You know, then once you're pondering human existence and afterlife and what art really means and do we live on for real or do we live on through what memories we leave or both, why bitch about comedy and stupid fans if you're thinking about that stuff? So, hey, look at that, guys. I think maybe a few weeks off did us some good. I think so. So, what do I have to tell you? No, I will not be doing any Zoom shows in March. Thank you to everybody who attended the shows over President's Day weekend. Much appreciated. Came up with some great bits. My bit on Marilyn Manson, I will post probably later this week. I have several videos coming out this week that I'm working on. My Malcolm Gladwell, my Mike Lindell versus Mitch McConnell rap battle, my Trump CPAC speech. So there'll be more content. So please, if you're not subscribed to the YouTube, go check out maybe what you've missed. Scroll through the pages of my YouTube. If you're not already, I must implore you to sign up for my newsletter on my homepage and my website. That's because I will be raising money for a big Haitian charity in March. So I will not be doing like real promotion of shows or gigs, but other than the free content I put out, the only thing I'll really be promoting in March will be this charity, Hope for Haiti, that I've been chosen as an ambassador for. So thank you. It's because I have more fans now that I'm actually valuable. Also, I gave them a huge check as part of my tithing in 2020, giving away tens of thousands to charities. Okay, Mackenzie Bezos. That's... I hope you can sign up for the newsletter and maybe support that with a few bucks when I start promoting that in the beginning of March. Other than that, I don't think there's anything else. Oh, gambling, guys. So I did bet a four. I can't do the Adams. I don't feel like doing the Uncut Gems thing. I bet a four. KG, I bet an 18 parlay and four teams lost in the parlay. This is how I lose. DraftKings put like $8 in my account, and I said, okay, and this is how I gamble. I go, okay, so if I bet $8 on this one game, I win $12. Okay, that's not fun. So then I end up doing like a 10-team parlay and going, oh, look, if all these teams win, I win $2,000, KG. But I bet an 18 parlay and four teams lost, but it was $8. But had they all won, I would have won like $2,000. That's the only fun in gambling. That's why I bet the Utah Jazz to win the title in the beginning of the season. And by the way, they were plus 3,600 at the beginning of the season. They are now plus 1,000. So my bet of $500 would only win me $5,000 right now, as opposed to my preseason bet, which will win me $18,000. So it's good to have faith in your squad. But I love the people who will say to me, oh, they're not going to win. And I go, well, yeah, probably not, but it's still a good bet. I know they probably won't win, but it's a smart bet. It's a good value bet. It's not like I bet the Knicks to win the title. I bet a team with longer odds than they should have had. So it's a good value bet. And I bet Damian Lillard to win MVP, which I still think there is a reasonable shot of. But that's it. That's all I've done on DraftKings right now. Since I'm getting fewer Cameo bucks and YouTube bucks right now, it's still, still great passive income from YouTube and Sound Exchange, but I've toned down my gambling. Like I haven't decided what my next gambling foray will be, but you will be notified when I decide. So, I guess thank you for listening to this. It felt good to not really bitch about comedy, because I did write a 3,000-word blog on my website where that's a lot of all I do. So I really got it out there. So please, all the free things, no purchase necessary this week. All I ask is if you're a real fan and you're listening to this, sign up for my newsletter. It's just once a month. You get an update from me on either shows or events or important things in my goings on. There's that. There's subscribe to the YouTube. Check out the videos you may have missed over the last few weeks. And what else? Newsletter. And give this podcast 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Let's get this up to like 200 ratings. Okay, we're at 140. I have way more listeners than that. So please, just if you like this episode or you like most episodes, give it a nice 5-star rating. And I don't know, it helps it somehow. I guess it just makes me feel better. I feel like, oh, good, there's still some activity. So that's it, folks. Pretty upbeat for me. Odd to say that. See, pondering human existence and death, somehow not as depressing for me as talking about stand-up comedy. So I don't know. Maybe I should join the clergy. Give up comedy and join the clergy. That's my old joke. It's like I'm saving for my retirement so that I can be happy in my 60s. But all I'd have to do to be happy in my 40s is quit comedy. And then I'd make more money in my retirement. It would work out for everything. But it's a compulsion. So we're going to ride it out. We're going to hopefully start booking some gigs for the spring, summer. Got to record an album in the summer, probably in Philly. That would be my first choice to record at Helium. A lot of stuff to share. Good stuff. Great stuff. And that's it. So thank you for listening. I'm back. And I'll see you next Tuesday.